welcome to Worlds Apart. The 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which fell this month, might have been of interest only to specialist historians if it weren't for the renewed confrontation between Moscow and Washington. With the threat of nuclear strikes making a comeback into the public consciousness, can we still learn anything from the way the two nations dealt with their potentially apocalyptic animosity back in 1962? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Norman Solomon, Executive Director for the Institute for Public Accuracy and author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Mr. Solomon, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, I know that you were born in the early 1950s and grew up in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. So I assume your childhood was colored by the fears of mushroom cloud. When you compare the current situation to the events of your childhood, which I know you studied professionally, which period do you think is more dangerous?
Well, I rely on a lot of the experts, such as the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, that says that in the last decade, the dangers have been more and more extreme in terms of global nuclear war. And we see just in this year that in the 10 months or so since the Bulletin made its last assessment, which was quite dire, the worst in decades, it's gotten even more dangerous situations. So subjectively, we've all, I think, grown up with these fears if we're paying attention. But in terms of expertise and those who assess with great background and professional knowledge, we're now at an extreme danger point, perhaps even more dangerous than 60 years ago during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was looking through some of the letters that Nikita Khrushchev and John F. Kennedy exchanged at that time, and I was struck by the sense of shared responsibility that were in those letters. For example, President Kennedy stressed that the United States is very interested in diffusing tensions and limiting the arms race. General Secretary Khrushchev was calling for state wisdom and suggesting that both sides need to resist escalatory dynamics. Do you think that mutual sense of both impending danger and shared duty is present today?
Well, one of the most disturbing aspects of what we're facing now here in the autumn of 2022 is the absence of exchange of information and any semblance of authentic diplomatic dialogue. There are great differences of opinion. I have great differences of opinion with RT, for example. And yet, I think some discussion about the overarching dangers of nuclear war are absolutely crucial, because let me just to step back for a moment in terms of overall perspective. The best scientific information says that a thermonuclear exchange, for instance, between the United States and Russia would result in nuclear winter, as it's been called. And as a consequence, 99% of the human beings on this planet would die within a year. So if we step back and we say only 1% of the human beings on this planet would be alive after a few months of a nuclear exchange, that helps us put in perspective what is at stake right now. Mm-hmm. And so when we hear loose talk coming from the Kremlin about use of nuclear weapons, that is absolutely abhorrent. And I say this as somebody who has worked very strongly for decades now to oppose U.S. militarism, mm-hmm, and to oppose the escalation of nuclear war. And so for Vladimir Putin to say that Hiroshima and Nagasaki are precedents is an absolutely unhinged and extremely dangerous statement to make.
Those were the precedents of the United States using nuclear weapons, the only country in history to do that. And when you say that
that
means that the United States is on record of using nuclear weapons. And what you describe as his loose talk, he never said, let's bomb Kyiv or let's bomb Washington. He said that Russia, if pressed, will use nuclear weapons to defend its security interests and its existence.
That's established doctrine. But also to say in this current crisis that Hiroshima and Nagasaki are precedents for using nuclear weapons in the future.
This is a historic precedent.
Do we want to say that the Excuse me, do we want to say that the Third Reich is a precedence? There's precedence for all sorts of atrocities on a massive scale. In this crisis, for President Putin to say that Hiroshima and Nagasaki are precedents is a way to terrorize the world. That is absolutely unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. Now, in addition to making that statement, President Putin repeatedly called for negotiations with Kyiv, with Washington, but I didn't hear anything of the sort from the Biden administration. In fact, all we are hearing from the American administration is that they're ready to support Ukraine till the end, whatever that end actually means. I would like to ask you, what's your sense of this conflict dynamics? Do you think we have actually reached the point when not only Moscow, but also Washington would be interested in not only pursuing its geopolitical gains, but actually cutting losses, including losses for Ukraine and for humanity, which you are so concerned about?
Well, what we have to have is diplomacy. What we have to have is negotiations. When we look at the reference to the Cuban Missile Crisis, what prevented the world from perhaps being essentially blown up was authentic dialogue, authentic diplomacy. And that has been absolutely lacking for all of this year in terms of the Ukraine crisis, now the Ukraine war. So certainly, and at rootsaction.org, we're supporting absolute dialogue. And that first begins with a ceasefire. And I'm not hearing any reference to support for a ceasefire coming from either side. And I have to say, when we have the Russian forces bombing Kyiv and other cities, that is a war crime. And I say that as somebody who has opposed U.S. war crimes. If you look at the bombing of electrical grids, for instance, that directly affect the livelihoods and the lives and the existence of civilians, how can we support that? And in the context of nuclear war, we cannot support bombing and terrorizing civilian areas and then say that has nothing to do with escalation towards nuclear war, because it does.
I would actually want to join you in your call for diplomacy. And I don't know if you've seen it, one of the former advisors to Richard Nixon, Dmitry Symes, recently published an article in the National Interest in which he also called for, quote unquote, a diplomatic will, which I think is a striking statement in and of itself, because even in the most pressing moments of the Cold War, we had back channel diplomacy going on between the two capitals. We have nothing of this sort anymore. Do you think the Biden administration can even afford any negotiations with the Kremlin? Because the Kremlin, according to Putin, is ready. Can the Biden administration afford any negotiations with Putin and the Putin administration after all the regime change statements that Mr. Biden has made?
Well, I hope that both sides will be willing to engage in genuine diplomacy, both back channel and in public. Problem is that when you have major cities and towns being bombed by Russian forces, that hardly is an incentive for sides to say there's a basis for negotiations. Therefore, we need a ceasefire. We absolutely need a ceasefire in Ukraine.
Well, I agree with you. Do you think the Americans are ready to support your call? Or if you think so, can you cite any single statement from the Biden administration that would actually call for a ceasefire in Ukraine over the last couple of months?
Well, if you agree that the U.S. and Russia should have diplomacy, then we're on the same page. If you also agree that the Russian government should stop bombing Ukraine, cities and towns, then we would also be in agreement. I think that is absolutely essential.
Well, Mr. Solomon, I think what the Russian military is doing in Ukraine is fighting not only with Ukraine, but with NATO, which keeps pumping Ukraine with weapons, with military advisors, which is continuing to use the land of Ukraine for its own very aggressive policy. So if you want the Russian military operation to stop, which I actually want because I have relatives in Ukraine, then I think the United States needs to stop fighting a proxy war with Russia. Don't you agree with that?
Well, the first step is that the invading force stop making war on the country that it invaded. I speak as somebody who went to jail opposing the Vietnam War. I've gone to jail opposing U.S. militarism. I'm somebody who denounced the U.S. bombing of civilian grids in Belgrade in 1999. These were all war crimes, just as now the Kremlin is committing war crimes inside Ukraine. So we have to say, stop the war crimes so we can have a ceasefire and negotiations.
Well, I agree with you, but I don't think you can hold my country to a higher moral standard than you hold your country. I think this is fundamentally unfair. International law only works when it's ubiquitous and universal. When only one country can afford not to apply it, then it means that the international law becomes a tool of repression, a weaponized tool, rather than what it's supposed to be, which is the protection for the civilians.
Well, if you want to have a race to the bottom of barbarism and brutality, we can certainly have a race to the bottom, and the end of that is nuclear war. So if we're going to have a single standard of international law, that means that one country doesn't invade another and bomb civilian areas.
You mentioned that there are the lines of communication between the Kremlin and the White House are fairly poor. And I heard former President Obama the other day voice the same concern. He also said that the United States has to be very mindful about the kind of weaponry it sends to Ukraine and think about where defense stops being a defense and becomes an offense. Do you think the Biden administration would take any cues from its former associate? Because President Obama doesn't often break his silence. If he does it at this point of time, it means that he himself is concerned not only the war in Ukraine and the potential of a nuclear apocalypse, but also the actions of his former colleague.
Well, you remind me of something that Martin Luther King Jr. spoke of. This is a phrase he used, the madness of militarism. And that madness is fully in place in Moscow right now. I'm afraid that the Kremlin has made a decision that it's okay to subject enormous suffering for enormous people of Ukraine, enormous numbers of people. And our organization, RootsAction.org, has been on record opposing NATO expansion for years. So we can certainly do a backstory analysis and see how the tensions have been exacerbated by NATO as well as by Russia. The question is now, what do we do now? And what we do now is we de-escalate. We have diplomacy. We have a ceasefire. And I think it's certainly within the power of the invading country, Russia, to declare a ceasefire. Then you can have better opportunities for genuine diplomacy.
Well, what we also will have to do now is to take a short break, but we will be back to this very important conversation in a while. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Norman Solomon, Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Now, Mr. Solomon, going back to the nature and the style of the Russian military operation in Ukraine, in describing it, you use such terms as, quote, the murderous rampage, barbaric mass slaughter, a killing spree, and you essentially equate the Russian style of war to the way Americans fought their wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and indirectly in Syria and Libya. And as a former war reporter, I absolutely reject this comparison because I think there is a massive difference in a way the Russians do it and the Americans do it. Sure, any war is horrible. It's the worst possible outcome. But one of the reasons why the Russians have been progressing so slowly is because they actually didn't allow themselves to carpet bomb cities the way the Americans do it. Again, we both agree that war is horrendous. But shouldn't we also be more nuanced about the way militaries are doing that, about the way the war fight is proceeding?
Well, what you just said is reminiscent of what the U.S. government said during the Vietnam War, during the Afghanistan War, during the invasion, and for years afterward.
We do a
humane war, unlike our enemies. This is complete nonsense. The terrorism from the sky that is coming from Russia into Kyiv and other cities is absolutely indefensible. There's nothing humane about it whatsoever. It's not a military operation. It is a war. It's a war that includes a war on civilians. And we should oppose that just as we oppose the U.S. invasion and war on Iraq and on Afghanistan. We need a single standard.
You mentioned that you've been speaking against the madness of the U.S. militarism for many decades. It left a pretty horrendous track record in the world. I just wonder what other means Russia could have used to repel NATO's encroachment towards its borders, something that we see as an existential danger. We've seen what happened to Yugoslavia. We've seen what happened to Libya. We've seen what happened to Syria. We are not imagining that the United States is dangerous. And when the United States was using, and this is public record, Ukrainian territory to pump arms there, to send their military advisors, what other means we as a nation had to put an end to it?
I can tell you what means did not exist that should have been pursued, and that is to invade and then make war on Ukraine. That should have been off the table, and then negotiations and diplomacy would be necessary.
But there weren't negotiations and diplomacy. Putin and Biden met in 2001 in Geneva, and they talked about not pushing the situation further, but the Americans still continued doing that. Arming Ukraine, using its land for its own military purposes, even not making it a member of NATO without taking any defense obligations whatsoever. How could we have put an end to that?
Well, I can tell you that invading and then slaughtering people in Ukraine is not a solution, nor does it reduce the chances of nuclear war. In fact, it increases the chances of nuclear war, which is what we began talking about.
Are you claiming that we should have betrayed our national security interests for the sake of Ukrainians, some of which are supporting their government that is using their land as essentially a platform for an offensive against Russia?
Well, it's an odd concept of national security to look at what's happened since February and think that that enhances Russia's nuclear security or national security. It does not. So we need other pathways. This in no way defends the expansion of NATO. As I said, personally and my organization has been opposing expansion of NATO for many years. And we know that it was wrong. We know that it was a betrayal of a promise made when the Berlin Wall fell. We know all that. The question is, how are we going to proceed in a constructive way that will reduce the chances of nuclear war rather than increase the chances, which is what has occurred this year?
You know, when I talk to respectable Russian experts, especially those who are old enough to remember the Cold War and the nuclear scare of that time, many of them tell me that what kept the world from being destroyed at that time was the mutual sense of fear that the Americans actually believed in the credibility of the Russian nuclear deterrent, and Russians too believed in the credibility of the American nuclear deterrent. I wonder if part of the reason, or perhaps the whole reason why we are where we are, is because America's total belief in its omnipotence and its belief in Russia's total impotence, the belief that Russia would never ever use the nuclear weapons to defend itself.
Well, certainly there is a thing that has been perceived as nuclear deterrence. If the way that we think Russia can defend its interests is to threaten to use nuclear weapons explicitly, then I think that's a terribly dangerous stance to take, which threatens really the survival of almost all of humanity.
Of course, it threatens the survival of almost all of humanity. That's what nuclear weapons are for. And that's actually, again, according to the Russian doctrine, at least, and according to many Russian specialists, that's what kept the world safe, because the Americans had this visceral fear of extinction, which kept their policies vis-a-vis Russia or vis-a-vis the Soviet Union at that time contained within the limit of sanity. Do you think the Americans at this point of time the Biden administration, do you think they believe that Russia is not bluffing when it says that it will defend itself?
Well, I think Russia is going to defend itself, whether Russia interprets or President Putin interprets that to mean to actually use nuclear weapons would be a descent into the kind of global barbarism that is unimaginable in terms of human beings. So I can't say what I know is inside the head of President Biden, but I can say that to pursue as though the implicit doctrine of both countries should now be made explicit to threaten perhaps imminent use of nuclear weapons should be so beyond anything that is acceptable or imaginable that it doesn't happen. And yet one of the horrible things that has happened this year and ominous things is that this threat has been made explicit by President Putin. That is simply wrong. It's hard to say how wrong that is because the consequences are potentially so catastrophic for all of humanity. Mm-hmm. That said, we know that the doctrine of the U.S. and the Russian military both accepts and embraces the option to be the first to use nuclear weapons. We know that's the doctrine of both countries, extremely dangerous. That's bad enough. But to threaten, as the Kremlin has, to actually go ahead and use it in a specific instance, I think is beyond the pale. It's absolutely unacceptable.
Now, despite the fact that, as you say, President Putin made that threat explicit, you also write that after going through more than 60 presidential statements, documents, and communiques that the White House has released over the last couple of months, there is a complete absence of nuclear weapons or mentioning the nuclear war dangers. Why do you think that is?
I think that there's a real effort by leaders of the United States and Russia to hide the realities of nuclear weapons and nuclear war, rather have happy talk, rather talk about our national mission and ring some jingoistic nationalistic bells than be honest with people. And I think what we need from Biden and from Putin is to be honest with their people and the people of the world. As Gorbachev and Reagan said, nuclear war cannot be won and must not be fought. It's not enough to say that. That's necessary, but insufficient. The posture, the behavior, the statements, and the actions of those leaders have to be in sync with that understanding. And we're really not getting actions that are in sync with that attitude from either side right now.
Well, I think the attitudes of leaders have to be in sync with reality. And I don't know if you are aware of that, but Russian cities are also being bombed, and Russia being bombed by the Ukrainians, being shelled at least. And Russia has offered refuge to more than 5 million Ukrainian refugees. So unlike the United States, for us, the war is very close to home, both within the Russian territory and, as I said, across the border in Ukraine, where most of us have relatives. Do you think the two sides have the same amount of issues at stake here? Do you think this war means the same for Russia as it means for the United States?
Well, it's completely unconvincing for Russia to play the victim in this war, since it's Russia that invaded Ukraine and continues to bomb major cities from the air in Ukraine.
So that you don't have any sympathy for the Russian, ordinary Russian people who are being killed in those strikes. And that just goes with them being Russians, right?
I have tremendous sympathy for everybody who dies in a war. I have tremendous sympathy for people who are drafted, conscripted, or bombed in a war. That's why we should oppose war, not just in abstraction, but continue to work towards diplomatic solutions and say that it's not okay to send people into battle to kill others and to kill civilians.
I also heard you say that the world is in a desperate need for some sort of a single standard of non-aggression and human rights. And I agree with you on that, having seen a lot of war zones and a lot of suffering that's going on there. But I have to ask you again, not as a propagandist, Russian propagandist, but as a person who was exposed to a lot of war suffering, is it possible without the United States abandoning its stance as an indispensable and omnipotent country? Because on the ground, it usually means that the United States can commit any crimes, any war crimes, with total impunity. And it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, Richard Nixon, Barack Obama, Joseph Biden, who are in office. And when you have that kind of behavior from the self-proclaimed leader of the free world, can you expect anything different from other countries?
The United States has been, in this century, the biggest propagator of violence and killing and warfare in the world. And it seems now this year that Russia is trying to catch up. That doesn't mean that what Russia is doing is in any way justified.
Well, it's not justified in a moral sense. It is justified in the military sense. And when I talk to my guests from all around the world, nobody supports the war action, but many of them say that this is a time when at least one country puts an end to this absolutely unrestrained behavior of the United States. And I have to be honest with you, that one of the reasons why so many countries are trying to remain neutral to the U.S. pressure to sanction Russia is precisely because of that, because they are fed up with American hegemony. Do you think the United States will abandon its superficial rights to command the world without trying to burn it down?
Well, in a military sense, alas, so often it seems to make sense to attack other countries and slaughter people, including civilians. I think whether we can move forward, as you allude to as a possibility, whether we can move forward to a more rational, decent, humane world depends on the people of the world. We need anti-war protesters in the United States and in Russia. When Russian anti-war protesters are put in prison, that is indefensible. It has happened to thousands in the last few months, just as elsewhere in the world, when people challenge nonviolently the madness of militarism are thrown in prison. That must be understood as a struggle between people at the grassroots who suffer from war and who understand and empathize towards those who suffer from war, rather than going along to get along with the war makers anywhere.
I am greatly appreciative of your time with us today. Thank you very much for expressing your thoughts.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.